being with us on the Electronic Intifada podcast.
Thank you.
Thank you, Nora.
And that wraps it up for another edition of Flashpoints. Our executive producer is Dennis Bernstein. Our technical director is Mike Biggs. For more information about the show, to listen to or download archived episodes, log on to flashpoints.net. For questions or comments about Flashpoints, you can contact Dennis at dennisjbernstein@gmail.com. Thank you for listening.
All right. Coming up next on KBOO, it's going to be Between the Covers. We'll hear a piece from the series Bookwaves with host Richard Walensky. We'll talk about the recently departed Umberto Eco, leading semiologist and novelist, and author of best-selling book Name of the Rose. And at 11:30, we'll hear Black Book Talk with our host Patricia Welch, a monthly program featuring interviews and discussions of works by African-American authors. The time is 11 a.m. You are listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO at the Clinton is our monthly film series at the Clinton Street Theater. This month, on Thursday, March 10th at 7 p.m., KBOO at the Clinton will show Salt of the Earth. Based on actual events, this film depicts a strike by Mexican-American mine workers in New Mexico. Against a backdrop of social injustice, a family drama is played out by a miner and his wife. Again, that's Salt of the Earth, Thursday, March 10th, 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Welcome to Bookwaves. I'm Richard Walensky.
Umberto Eco, who died on February 19, 2016 at the age of 84, was one of the world's leading semiologists studying the relationship of signs and symbols to meaning and language. He was also a well-known and well-respected novelist. The Name of the Rose, a detective novel set in the Middle Ages, became a surprise bestseller, and he followed it up with Foucault's Pendulum and five later novels. On June 15, 2005, I had a chance to sit down with Umberto Eco in the KPFA studios while he was on tour for his novel, The Mysterious Flame of Queen Loana. His English was good, though it was clearly not his mother tongue.
You are known as a semiotician, and all of your books reflect semiotics. So let's start by asking, what exactly is semiotics?
First of all, I spent the last 30 years in writing a lot of books about that topics and without reaching a definite conclusion. So I can summarize it in few words. Let's say that is more than a science, a sort of field of interconnected approaches to all the ways we use in order to communicate. So not only language, but images and narration and so on and so forth, trying to see if there is a certain common ground, a common mechanism, either of our mind, of our brain, of our culture in general, that unifies all those things, all those ways to transmit meanings to each other. You know, when I get the question if there is a semiotic influence on my novels, I usually answer no. As far as I am concerned, when I start writing a novel, I feel like in a vacation situation. I am not obliged to think of my academic work. Not only, I don't want to make theoretical abstract plans. I start from an image in writing a novel. But my readers afterwards find a lot of connections between my academic work and my novels, which is not so incredible, because I am not such a split personality. I am not a schizo person. And so it's evident that there is a connection. But it is not the result of a conscious project. I don't consider my novel illustrations of my theories, or my theories reflections of my novels.
But it does come through. And in reading the various novels, we see this examination of signs and meaning,
yes,
and metaphor. I mean, it follows through in every single one of your books.
No, I say that it is not on purpose. It is not a cold decision.
In your collection of essays on literature, you do talk about the relationship of a novel's story or plot and the subtexts of the novel, which is what we're talking about here, various kinds of subtexts, and that the subtext could be conscious or could be unconscious or may not even be part of the writer's decision-making process.
Well, I used to say that sometime a book, not necessarily a novel or a poem, but even in a book of essays, is frequently more intelligent than his or her author. I make you a typical example, something that happens when dealing with my translators. I collaborate with my translators for many evident reasons, because I think that translation is important. And being a semiotician, translation is a subject matter that concerns me directly. It happens sometimes that my translators say, but this sentence or this passage is pretty ambiguous. And you have four possible answers. In certain cases, you're right. I misuse my language. It is awkward. Please, I didn't want to be ambiguous translating in a very clear way. I will maybe correct my Italian edition for the second or third edition. The second answer could be, I wanted to be ambiguous. Okay, and so please keep the same ambiguity in your translation. But the third case is, I didn't want to be ambiguous, but certainly your reading is okay. My text was ambiguous, and this ambiguity is fruitful, is enormously interesting. So keep it in your translation. But that is a case in which the text is more intelligent than its author.
Do you find when you're writing a book at all, and I could see it a little bit, you know, in Queen Loana, though, maybe in a book like Island of the Day Before, it's even stronger, where, I mean, you can't be blind to your own interest popping up there. Do you have to sometimes suppress your own feelings about the subtext of what you're writing?
It's very difficult to answer, because sometimes when you realize that there can be a wrong interpretation or a misinterpretation or a hyperinterpretation, I try to reduce it. I make you a very typical example. My novel, The Foucault's Pendulum, has this title because the inventor of the pendulum was Foucault. If the inventor was Franklin, the title would have been The Franklin's Pendulum. But since the novel is about a certain discussion that can remind the reader of Michel Foucault, I immediately had the feeling that somebody could have interpreted Foucault like a reference to Foucault. And so I introduced in the text many hints in order to make clear that I was talking of Léon Foucault and not of Michel Foucault. But I couldn't stop readers to find connections. And probably some connections are there. I read Foucault 10 and more years before writing The Pendulum. Those connections would have been there even though the title was The Franklin's Pendulum. But if it was The Franklin's Pendulum, nobody would have remarked those analogies.
Well, they may have come up with different ones at that point, because then there are different resonances. I mean, you know, the ultimate example is Finnegan's Wake, where everything refers to everything.
Yes, but this is on purpose. But I have to insist on a theoretical point. I have always been interested in what is called now reader-oriented criticism of a continuous interaction between a text and its readers. And I started in 1962 with that book that in English was the open work and published it later. But at a certain point, I felt the risk of intending this cooperation as a sort of overwhelming power of the reader that can do everything he or she was of a text. And I always said, no, the text is something that exists there before your reading.
Right.
You are free to interpret it in different ways. It's difficult to say whether interpretation is a good one, but it's easy to say even interpretation is a bad one. There is a typical case I discussed in one of my essays, I don't remember which one, published in English too, of a clear misinterpretation of Finnegan's Wake. It was a long debate on the fact that at a certain point Joyce mentioned Beria. And since a few pages before he had mentioned something linked to Hitler, like the Anschluss and so on, so people said, oh, is the Beria the Soviet minister? Then some critics said, but you know, Beria became a minister after the publication of Finnegan's Wake, so Joyce couldn't quote that. Finally, another critic discovered that a few pages before, one page before, Joyce was mentioning Joseph, the biblical Joseph, and Beria was one of his brothers. So the connection was a biblical one. No doubt it would have been a false interpretation to connect Joyce with the Soviet Union.
Umberto Eco, your latest novel, The Mysterious Flame of Queen Loana, deals with a character named Yambo, who has lost memory of his own life. However, he retains the memory of everything that he read.
Which is scientifically correct. I mean, there are many clinical cases of this kind.
The book is divided into three sections, and it struck me that they seem to reflect, I don't know how conscious this was, three stages of knowledge. The first is being told something. The second is finding it out for oneself. And the third is remembering it.
Yes, I realized only later that it was a sort of early sonata in three movements, even though not following exactly the rules of the genre, let's say an allegro, an andante, and an adagio. But I was pretty conscious in writing of the fact that the first part is, well, the situation of a man who has lost his memory. I enjoyed also imagining possible situation, you know, at a certain point. He cannot remember. He had a love affair with his beautiful and young assistant. And it's an embarrassing situation because being a gentleman, he cannot ask. She knows that he has lost his memory. And she, if something happens, she cannot speak. I try to imagine several possible situations. In the second, in a way, it was for me the most important part, because the character going in the attic in his countryside home doesn't reconstruct his own memory, because he's working on a sort of a mineral or paper memory, comic books, school books, records, newspapers. And in doing that, he's reconstructing the memory of his generation. That's why I insist when people say, ah, this is an autobiography, I say no. I gave my character a lot of my personal memories because we have the same age and so forth, and we lived the same 30s and 40s during the dictatorship in Italy. But it was important to me to make a sort of generational retrieval, and that's also the function of the illustrations, because they are evidences that of certain historical material that belongs to the entire generation. The third part, as you said, is on the contrary, for the majority of our listeners who have not read the book, he lost his memory because of a first stroke. He has clearly a second stroke. He enters a coma, where while outside they believe he is in a flat situation, he step by step retrieves his personal memories, including the memory of his first love and so on and so forth. I don't say how the book ends, because me too, I am not so sure of the way it ends. There are those three movements: lost memory, collective memory, personal memory.
The second part deals mostly with the propaganda and
yes,
the elements of propaganda, which, coming back again to work in semiotics, reminded me of the work a little bit of George Lakoff in dealing in America with metaphor and politics.
Certainly, I know very well the work of George. We're friends. I consider George Lakoff a semiotician, even he okay. doesn't know, like Monsieur Jourdain in Molière, who was making prose without knowing it. It's important to use all the technical paraphernalia of linguistics, of semiotics, of rhetoric, also in order to understand how the political discourse works in our days. In the 70s, and since I was in this country in that period, the Watergate period, I made an analysis of the last Nixon speech when he tried to justify himself. And making a sort of parallel analysis of the classical structure of a Western movie by demonstrating that it was using the same techniques. And in a way, he could have convinced his listener, except that he was not speaking by radio, but speaking by TV. And the text of the speech was, according to me, perfectly organized in order to convince people. But his face and his hands were contrasting what he was saying. Well, you see, it's always possible to make this kind of analysis, also because one of the best pieces in linguistic analysis was the analysis made by the great belated linguist Roman Jakobson on the Antony speech in Shakespeare. And it's also a way to educate people to read between the lines. One of the aspects of my story in the second part is when Yambo realizes how his grandfather was reading the fascist newspapers between the lines. It was always possible to understand what really happened, even though they were lying. And reading between the lines is enormously important, because makes the reader or the listener free in comparison with the source of information.
You're listening to a 2005 interview with the late novelist Umberto Eco. I'm Richard Walensky on Bookwaves.
Do you think that even with the more sophisticated propaganda of today, the same holds true?
You know, somebody told during a debate on the new technologies and information that if Internet existed during the Second World War, the Holocaust would have been possible, because a major circulation of information would have changed probably even the plans of the Nazi. I don't know. It's true, but certainly all those that after the war said, "I didn't know," couldn't, because with the Internet. So the circulation of information today is a good therapy, because you can lie through a certain channel, but you are immediately counteracted by another channel. So the plurality of channels is always a way to make more fruitful comparison between the way of giving news.
But at the same time, you've got this plethora of information, this enormous amount of information. You need to sort it.
That's another problem. I have written a lot about that fact, that before Internet, we were able to select information, because if I buy the New York Times, by the title I understand what is more or less the line, the ideological penchant of the. And if I buy a book, let's say, published by Columbia University Press, I know that probably the text has been checked pretty well. If not, it wouldn't have been published. While with Internet, you don't know how much reliable is your source. And if you are an expert in a certain domain, you can check. Well, if I consult Internet, let's say, on some philosophical subject, I realize immediately the emitter is the mad one or something. But if I did something similar in chemistry, I have no instruments to tell what happens with a young man who has not the instruments to select and to filter information. That is an important problem and a great risk. But we started speaking, let's say, of the political information about events. The news about a given event, in any case, circulate. Then you can ask whether the source is reliable or not. So it's a great educational problem too. Also because people is so fond of false plots. They take him seriously, the Da Vinci Code. They don't know that all this stuff was sold in the bookstore since 50 years about occult stuff. They take it seriously. And people are always fond of plots. But, you know, Karl Popper wrote an important essay saying that people need to imagine plots and conspiracy in order not to feel responsible for what they are doing.
Your ruminations on that, is that in a sense, Umberto Eco, the origins of Foucault's pendulum?
Yes, it's exactly that. Foucault's pendulum is this story. I wrote it always remembering this definition of Chesterton: when people do not believe any longer in God, it is not that they believe in nothing, they believe in everything.
Do you think the success of the Da Vinci Code has to do with what's going on in the world today, or if a book like that had come out 15 years ago? I know Foucault's Pendulum was successful too, but this is successful beyond belief.
But Foucault's Pendulum, it was clear that it was a grotesque representation of this way of thinking, why Da Vinci Code takes this way of thinking as a good one. Yes, I am sure that if published 10 or 15 years ago, he wouldn't have had such a success, because, I repeat, there existed already Bajant and Lincoln and a lot of other books that were telling the same story. And even if you consider that certainly Dan Brown writes very well, he made a good page turner, it's not enough to justify the success. In a era of complete discomfort in face of everything happens, terrorism, and after 9/11, yes, it was easier to take seriously another plot. This, in the same way in which what happened justifies a certain return of fundamentalism and so forth, certainly.
In looking at all of your books, I keep finding these connections. So Bartolino is about lying or telling tales. Mysterious Flame of Queen Loana comes at it at a different angle, and I wonder...
Yes, it's about truth.
It's about truth, and
I wonder... He wants to find his own identity.
But it's also to find the identity of Italy itself and of Italy's relationship to truth. And I'm wondering what that connection is, if any, between writing a book like Bartolino and getting to a book right afterward like Queen Loana.
I don't know. You could ask Homer why in a book he described the siege of a city and the second, the trips of the first. They are two different subjects. The Mysterious Flame has to do with a quest for truth, because being a biographical book, if not strictly autobiographical, about the search for an identity, obviously the theme was that. While Bartolino, but in the same way as the Foucault's Pendulum, was about how the big lies can create a culture, society, history. In any case, the quest for truth in Loana is at the same moment also the confrontation of the protagonist and of the generation with the big lie of the dictatorship. So how they succeeded in escaping the big lie. You know that Federico Fellini, the movie maker, was older than me, but so means that he lived all the fascist years completely more than me, but I got out at the age of 13, once said to a friend, if with the kind of education we received, we have not become complete idiots, it was a miracle. In a way, my novel is the effort to show that it was not a miracle. There were the elements for the... And I tried to explain how even a young man, a boy, was in the same moment, the same day of the same year, submitted to the fascist song, to the hammering propaganda rhetoric of the regime. And on the other side, reading other books and even American comic strips and movies and song. And at a certain point, I or my Yambo say, we had a schizophrenic education. Yes, It was a schizophrenic education, but this sort of schizophrenic input was the one that stopped the generation to become complete idiots, at least the 50% of them.
Over the past 50 years, people have gone back and re-examined. Why do you think it took Italy so long, or maybe over here it only appears that it did, to really re-examine its fascist past?
No, I wouldn't say so. Italy made its own exam of consciousness certainly a lot before Germany, and even before France, that with the Vichy period, they have still certain problems. I mean, the public historiography immediately examined all the documents. What happens today, in which the right and even the extreme right are at the government, they are trying to revise the same documents. They are not discovering something new, simply in order to interpret them from the other point of view and to look for a final justification. Let's say even those who lost, they were in good faith. They acted as men of honor, which in many cases was true, and even the partisans committed some even massacres, which cannot be denied, because in the civil war, even in the American civil war, on both sides, there were horrible things perpetrated. So it's a sort of revisionism, not so much of the events, but of the intentions. It is not the discovery of new incredible document putting the whole story upside down.
Umberto Eco, your first novel came kind of out of the blue, Name of the Rose. You were a noted professor. You'd written several academic texts. You talked a little bit about it, the idea that suddenly you got this idea you wanted to kill a monk in an abbey.
Well, it was a boutade. It was a way to answer a question. I didn't want to kill a monk, and as a matter of fact, I didn't.
Well.
But it is true that I was fascinated by an old memory of myself in a Benedictine abbey. I was at the age of 16 there, and I found a marvelous library with stained glass windows, and there was a lectern in which I was turning the pages of an old book or a manuscript that I was fascinated by. And one day I had the idea, not of myself, but of a monk dying while reading a book. And I told you that I start a novel starting by an image. Suddenly a certain image excites my mind, and then I try to invent the plot. But I don't start from a precise idea about the plot. I start from an image, and then from 1 year or more, I design maps, situations, architectures. I have the need of setting up a world in order to make my characters to move in.
We used to say about the book, Sherlock Holmes and Dr. Watson in the 14th century.
Certainly, it's not by chance that I called William of Baskerville. Then I repented a little, because if I hadn't named him this way, and I had eliminated some references to Sherlock Holmes, the book would have been the same, but this would have not distracted many readers or reviewers. But it happened this way, and I have to accept my fate.
When you look at the movie of it, I mean, obviously it's by a different person, it's a different... What do you see of your own work there, then?
When I gave the permission for the movie, I was conscious from the beginning that it would have been the job of another person, a free interpretation. So I'm not this kind of authors that afterwards start to say, oh, he betrayed my intentions. The only thing that I asked expressly was that in the titles, it was the name of Rose, a palimpsest from a novel. It means that it was a great script, original manuscript, rewritten. Okay. It was not that the problem. It was that afterwards, there were millions of people reading the book after having watched the movie. And this is very embarrassing for an author, because it means that another person decided to suggest your reader what to see. And it is this is the reason why I asked my publisher to refuse for the new novel any possible offer from a movie.
When you finish a novel, do you ever think you're going to write another one, or do you kind of just go, well, my God, I did it?
No, when I finish, I say probably this is the last one, yes, because I don't finish having already an idea for the... And I don't feel pressured. The Pendulum took me 8 years, The Island 6 years. I am not one book per year author. I do it only if it comes spontaneously and not on command.
You've been listening to an interview recorded on June 15, 2005 with Umberto Eco, who died February 19, 2016 at the age of 84. An extended version of this interview can be found at Radio Walensky in the Area 941 section of the kpfa.org website. I'm Richard Walensky on Bookwaves.
Bookwaves is produced by Richard Walensky in the studios of KPFA Pacifica Radio.
A new Vaudevillian tradition. March 13th at 7 p.m. at the Steep and Thorny Way to Heaven in Portland. Oddville, a new vaudevillian tradition, is a brand new variety show style monthly night, taking cues from vaudevillian traditions and narrative comedy. Each month's showcase features a different lineup of performers, bringing together a wide range of artistic disciplines and focusing on polished short pieces from our thriving clown, circus, vaudevillian, and alternative performance communities right here in Portland. Again, that's Oddville, March 13th at 7 p.m. at the Steep and Thorny Way to Heaven, 1464 Southeast 2nd Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Where is your radio dial on Thursday afternoons from noon until 2? 90.7 FM is the place to be. Twice a month, DJ Charlie presents the World Beat Connection with the hottest Afro-Caribbean sounds in Portland radio land. Reggae, salsa, soca, New Orleans Afro-funk, Haitian compa and rara, and Antillean zouk share the airwaves with African high life. Afrobeat, Congolese soukous, Malian blues, juju, and South African kwaito, among the other great styles. Traditional and modern expressions are all included.